Müller House Meeting, Friday afternoon, 4th April, 1975. Transcendence is infinite and omnipresent. Therefore, in actual fact, there is no special path to transcendence. And yet, every single person has a path. And this path is his own living being. Because his own being lives and functions in a unique way. This is one of the deep significances of individuality. Each one of us, every single thing in the universe, is the expression of transcendence. Transcendence presses out of its own infinite self millions and millions of particulars, each of which is unique. This is the beauty of eternal God. And each particular which is expressed, that is pressed out of transcendence, in its living process, is its own path. We must appreciate this first very fully. It is easy to fall into the mistake of thinking, ah well, I will go my own way and do what I think is right. But that is a willful approach by someone who is still ignorant of the fact that he does not know himself. He does not really know the truth of his own being. If he really knew the truth of his own being, he would be quite free from all willfulness and from imposing his desire upon not only the outer world, but upon himself. Therefore, a man has to realize something of real freedom from within in order that his own being may show his own true path. And to have this freedom, he must realize full self-restraint. That is to say, he has not got to compel himself to do so and so or not to do so and so. His business is to be alert and watchful, observe the circumstance, understand the circumstance, and then act as virtuously as is possible for him in that circumstance. If he does that and lives in that manner, he is exercising real self-control, not a false self-control. Then there is no repression. There is no neurosis or psychosis consequent upon that. Nor is there any evil doing by him. We have to understand this very clearly, because, as we all know, the whole world is full of rampant egoists, imposing their will, imposing their desire upon their environment. And hence, there is only misery, conflict, failure, illness. So, realizing deeply within ourselves that true freedom comes into being at the peak point of true self-restraint, intelligent self-restraint. Then we can look into ourselves and discover what is our true path, our own individual true path in accord with the real nature of our own individual being. I suggested this morning this web of consciousness, which is the light of the soul of the individual person. And our business is to tend that light and follow that light. This light of the soul is really our own star of destiny. Poets have talked of a star of destiny. This is your star of destiny. And if there has been the discipline of self-restraint and the emergence of the reality of freedom as a human being, then this star will shine brighter and brighter through the years. So now, this star of your own destiny will light your pathway to the realization of transcendence in your own unique way. Is it not an extraordinary fact that the teachings of the great teachers, the founders of the great religions, is a teaching about one and the same ultimate reality? But every teaching as presented to the people who are around the teacher is outstandingly original. It's quite different in its expression from the teaching of any other teacher. And yet, it is the same teaching. Those who are inspired by the teacher, out of devotion maybe, or out of a certain degree of short-sightedness, take hold of the word of the teacher and declare, this is the truth and there is nothing else, there is no other way. These people forget something which the teachers understood so well, that the word of the teacher raises up a mental construct in the mind of the listener. The listener forms a pattern of ideas, of beliefs, convictions, and so forth, doctrines, dogmas. And that pattern in the mind of the follower, of the listener, is a very limited pattern. And invariably, to some degree or other, misinterprets the teacher. So, one has to take count, take into account these mental patterns which are formed in our own minds when we study the word, the printed word of the scripture, or the spoken word of the living person. The absolute reality which is within any one mind is not directly conveyed to the other mind. There are exceptions. When the disciple has gone so far that the teacher, seeing what he has realized, entitles him to be released from the conditioning imposed by the teacher's words, he helps the disciple to realize the unconditioned state. The teacher cannot decondition the disciple. That cannot be done. Because it is the disciple who holds fast to the idea, to the ideas, the mental patterns formed in his mind. And as I said this morning, there is no interference by one who understands. It is the business of the disciple to free himself from this conditioned state of beliefs, doctrines, dogmas, all the mental constructs in his own mind. And as this process goes on, through pure attentiveness to those very ideas and beliefs, an attentiveness which dissolves the structure, the psychical structure of those beliefs, as this process goes on, then the mind becomes clean. It becomes quite transparent, empty of all the obstructions which fill it. Then the disciple has reached the unconditioned state where he sees truth directly without intermediary. You will find this in all the great religious teachings of the world. In Christian mysticism, for instance, Jan van Ruysbroeck says quite openly in his wonderful little work, The Sparkling Stone, that then one sees the whole truth without intermediary, without the necessity of Jesus Christ himself being the mediator between man and God. It's extraordinary how the church allowed that sort of statement to get into print in his days. But there it is. It's in Christian mysticism, and of course it has always been the accepted thing in India, in the great religions of India, that ultimately the reality is realized in aloneness, complete aloneness. The aloneness which is not cut away from others, but the aloneness which is the consequence of the realization that there is only one I am, and no I a separate self from the one and only I am. And that, of course, is the one only, the alone. It's in that sense that the word alone is used. Now there is another situation. The master and the disciple can directly communicate without words, without concepts. A direct transmission from mind to mind. We have a remarkable example of this in the Old Testament, the second book of Kings. I think it is the first or second chapter, verses 1 to 11. That wonderful journey of Elisha and Elijah walking together. Those of you who have looked into it will remember the story. Elisha was the disciple of Elijah. Now remember that all these old names had their own meanings. Elijah, Eliyah, means God himself. Elisha means God the Savior. Now Elisha was the disciple of Elijah, and the description is now given of how they walked together. This is a symbolical description, how they walked together and come to Gilgal. Now the word Gilgal, the name Gilgal, means the round, going round and round. You see, what is our human life like? We are all caught in the circle of mortality, of birth, the progress of life, death. This is in physical terms. But every day of our lives, in our thought, in our feelings, in the way in which we are conscious of every event, we associate this self-consciousness with it all, and in any particular event or situation or action, by associating self-consciousness, we are born in that. We go through the event, it comes to the end. We have lived in that and we have died whilst the body is alive. And this goes on every day. And this is the fundamental real meaning of rebirth, reincarnation. This one self-consciousness, I am I, Feroz Mehta, I am not John Smith or anybody else, you see. This self-consciousness takes birth and dies in every single event. And this is the only real meaning of reincarnation as ordinarily pictured. And this is the round. This self-association with all the ephemeral things of this world, the passing events, being caught in the illusion, oneself being caught in the illusion that here is something most worthwhile, most permanent. It isn't. Only transcendence is the one worthwhile, the one permanent. And that cannot be seized, it cannot be described. Remember yesterday I read Yajnavalkya saying the Atma cannot be seized. It cannot be caught hold of and kept for yourself. So this is Gilgal. The two come, Elijah and Elisha come to Gilgal. And there at Gilgal, there are 50 sons of the prophets who say to Elisha, don't you know that this day your master will be taken away from your head? And Elisha says, yes, I know it. Who are these sons of the prophets? What is the meaning of the word son in all the scriptures of the world? You'll find the Buddha speaking in the same way. You will find the Upanishad speaking in the same way. So and so, the son of so and so, the son of so and so, the son of so and so. These sons are not necessarily, and in fact not usually, the sons in the biological sense. The teacher, the master, is not the physical father of the one who is called the son. When any one of the teacher's disciples came to that station, to that level, where he was ready to receive direct transmission from the Master, it was declared, he is the Son. This has to be remembered. And this is something which is an old esoteric teaching, and it has never been properly given out at all in the world. That is the real meaning of the Son. The Buddha declares that his disciple Sariputta was the Son of his own mouth, of his own word, of the truth itself. And so he declared he was his Son. And you will find the same in the Upanishads, where the great line of teachers is mentioned. So-and-so, the son of so-and-so, the son of so-and-so. And in St. Luke's Gospel, the third chapter, you remember how Jesus, the son of Joseph, the son of so-and-so, 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 and 77 names are mentioned until he comes to the end, the son of Adam, which was the son of God. And the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad speaks in identical terms, so-and-so, the present one here, the son of so-and-so, and a large list of names follows, coming finally to someone who is the son of Brahma. And Brahma is Svayambhu, self-existent. He has no begetter. That's the ultimate. Now one has to understand the esoteric meaning of all these things. Then one begins to understand more clearly and logically just exactly what is meant by the path and so forth. So Elijah and Elisha pass on from Gilgal and they arrive at Bethel. But what is Bethel? Bethel means the house of the Lord. But the Lord hasn't got a material house to which anybody can go. They come to the house of the Lord. Then again the same thing happens. The sons of the prophets tell Elisha, "Know ye not that this day," etc. And Elisha says, "Yes, I know it." And Elijah and Elisha still go on, as they say, talking to each other, till they arrive at Jericho. And the name Jericho means fragrance. What is this fragrance? It is the fragrance of the holy life. You find it as, in actual fact, in the, I think it's in the Mass. In the Mass. The sweet savor of a holy life. That's the phrase used there. And Jericho, the name means the place of fragrance. They arrived there. And again the sons of the prophets speak. And again the same thing happens. And they move on till they come to the Jordan. Now the meaning of the word Jordan is not too clearly known. But as far as I can make out, it has reference to the fact that there are two streams, physically two. There is a parting of the ways, in fact. They come to the place of the parting of the ways. And then Elijah turns around and says to Elisha, "Ask now what thou wilt, before I be taken away from thee." And Elisha says, "Let a double portion rest upon me." The meaning of double portion is just this. The Jewish custom was that a man, if he say he had five sons, the first son got twice as much as each of the other four. the eldest son's portion was twice as much as each of the other four. And that was the double portion. But certainly Elijah wasn't a wealthy man. He had nothing at all of his own. And Elijah says to Elisha, "It is a hard thing you have asked of me. But if you see me when I am taken up, so shall it be unto you." And then suddenly, there is the statement of the horsemen of Israel and the fiery chariot. And Elijah is taken up in the chariot to heaven, as it is said. But Elisha sees it and says, "O my father, the horsemen of Israel," and so forth. And at that moment, the mantle of Elijah is said to fall on Elisha. Now, this is one of the most wonderful tales of myths of direct transmission from master to disciple. Gilgal, I've explained, Bethel, the house of the Lord. The house of the Lord is the inner sanctuary within yourself when you are in that state of meditation where you are utterly free, psychologically and spiritually. You're utterly free and you're pure. Pure in your soul. That is the house of the Lord. Then, in that house, there is the fragrance of truth. The truth which is beyond all description, which is beyond intellectual conceiving. And you'll find this identical picture presented in the Kaushitaki Upanishad, that the disciple comes as he approaches Brahma, the Supreme Being. He comes to the place of fragrance. It's extraordinary how all these teachings are alike if you take the trouble to penetrate into them. And then that fragrance is the great uplifting power which enables Elisha to continue with Elijah till he comes to the actual parting of the ways. Now, what is this fiery chariot which takes Elijah up into the heavens? You know how in the symbolism of Hatha Yoga, of Kundalini Yoga, they talk about the various chakras, the great centers, the psychical centers in the body. In Buddhist terminology, in the Buddhist presentation rather, the seventh chakra, which is the home of the Holy Spirit itself, of Shiva, and the center between the eyebrows, where the voice of the master is heard, as they say, they regard that as one. This is one wheel of the chariot. The next wheel is the center at the throat. When that is active, the one who speaks, speaks prophetically. Prophetically, not meaning that he tells you what's going to happen to you in 2 years and 3 months hence to your house or business or anything. It's not foretelling the future. Prophetic speech is that speech which so inspires the listener that he wakes up from within himself and is able to realize something of the transcendent reality to which he is completely related. That is the meaning of prophesying, of prophetic speech. The other wheel is the center at the heart, the center where the individual is completely at one with all humanity. This is all the symbolism of yoga. This is what actually happens is psychological and spiritual. Spiritual in the sense of the power of the mind to bring about actual results psychophysically. And the fourth wheel is the center at the navel. The center at the navel, which does the work of eating and of digesting all your sense experience, all your thought processes, and so forth. In other words, it is the clarification of your intellectual perception. So now, these are the four wheels of the chariot. And who is the rider? In this case, it was Elijah himself, God himself, who is the rider. It is transcendence embodied in you, the supreme state of consciousness of which you yourself could be capable, which rises up and goes to heaven, as it is put. Now, the teaching has to be continued afterwards, hasn't it? And the mantle of Elijah falls upon Elisha. The mantle is that which in the Kabbalah is talked of as the Shekhinah, the glory of God. And the glory of God at his own divine level is identical with his manifested creation. See? And it is this mantle which is set to fall upon Elisha. So here is a case of this direct transmission from the master to the disciple, without any thought, without any words intervening between them. In very simple terms, two such people can sit in meditation together, and without a single word being spoken, the two know an at-one-ment and an entry together into deeper and deeper states of consciousness till the final state in which transcendence itself is fully expressed. One might ask, what is the use of this to the world? Two people have entered into a transcendent state, and then they come out of it like anybody else, and the world suffers and goes on. That is what the ordinary man whose eyes are blinded by the dust of worldliness would say. That is what he would say. He doesn't know just what forces there are throughout the universe and how they operate. It is a question which we need not go into, because it is a hypothetical question and it leads nowhere. What we have to understand clearly is that here is an example given of how each person realizes himself, his own being, as his proper path. As I said, in the Upanishads too, you find this direct transmission. In Buddhism, you find this great teaching of direct transmission in that extremely simple statement. The Buddha holds up a flower. No, it is Kashyapa, isn't it? The disciple, Kashyapa, who holds up a flower, I forget now which way around it is, and the other one smiles. It is the smile of complete understanding, a direct transmission, no words, no systematized thought attached to it. So now, we come back to the question of the path. There is a verse In the Rig Veda, which is very instructive, King Varuna hath made a spacious pathway, a pathway for the sun, wherein the sun, S-U-N, the sun shining in the heavens, for the sun wherein to travel. Where there was no way, he, King Varuna, made the disciple set his footstep and warned from afar whatever afflicts the spirit. Now, Varuna in the Rig Veda is the governor, the moral governor of the universe. Obviously, there is no entity called Varuna who sits in court or in judgment, some celestial court, being a moral governor of the universe. The name Varuna signifies the vast expanse, the universal expanse. It is like the Greek Uranus. And the Sanskrit root var means to measure not in our material sense of measuring distances. It means to evaluate rightly. And since Varuna is the moral governor of the universe, he represents the embody of absolute virtue. This is what he embodies. And it is this transcendent virtue which is embodied in us too. Only we are blind to it. We don't hear the voice. This absolute virtue which is embodied in us is the root source which is our instructor. How to act, how to feel, think and speak every day in the world. This transcendent power of virtue, this is what the name Varuna represents. And he's called a king, of course, by the poets of the Rig Veda. King Varuna hath made a spacious pathway, a pathway for the sun wherein to travel. Now, of course, the sun is the physical object that we know, but there is the sun within us too. It is that in us. It represents the potentiality for supreme enlightenment. That is the meaning of the word sun in this context. The sun is also one of the great gods of the Rig Veda, as they are called, Surya. Surya is the light that shines by day. Mitra, whose name also means friendship and the fulfillment of honorable contracts. Your word, having given your word, you must fulfill it. Mitra is the sun that shines by night. An extraordinary idea. And third, there is Savitri, which is the sun that shines by day and by night. Surya, the sun that shines by day, represents our insight and our enlightenment through our conscious life. Mitra, the sun by night, symbolizes this enlightened state which persists through our conditions of unconsciousness. For example, when we sleep. And Savitri, the sun that shines by night and day, represents the enlightenment of the perfected Holy One, which is independent of both the conscious and the unconscious, as we call it. That is what Savitri represents. So, it is very significant that it is transcendent virtue which makes a spacious pathway which enables enlightenment to take place. What is one of the full significances of this? Haven't you noticed that all the great founders of the religions laid special emphasis upon the moral life, the purity of mind and the purity of heart? You look at their teachings and you will find again and again that the great emphasis is upon living the good life. Be harmless, be truthful, honest. Do not give way to self-indulgence, and so on. The simple things. And when the one who really cares for the religious life, who is really urged from within himself to bring the purpose of life itself to fulfillment through his own being, he starts with trying to be virtuous. He has to struggle against temptations. He has to struggle against the uprising of anger or hate or greed and so forth. He is, in short, in the ambivalent state. He doesn't know what transcendent love or wisdom is. He only knows the duality of love-hate because he is still at the psychical level only. He cannot enter that deeper state of consciousness. He has not yet entered Bethel, the house of the Lord, and reached later on the state of fragrance. So he's in this, caught up in this round. But through attentiveness, as he purifies himself, he comes to that other stage where the ambivalence disappears and virtue now becomes more and more natural and spontaneous for him. He doesn't have to struggle to be virtuous. In culmination, in perfection, in the holy life, what do you find with the holy ones? That they live the pure life without any strain, without any difficulty. So you start with virtue in the state of struggle. The culmination is the virtuous man, the purified man. This is the perfected one, the holy one. This is the fruition of the religious life. Now, if his life is like that, utterly virtuous, there is no self intruding upon anything and everything. He is utterly selfless. This has to be borne in mind, so that it is not merely a case of a particular man being virtuous in a remarkable degree, but the virtue of God himself is manifest through that man. That's why that man can heal. You know, you all know about the miracles of Jesus. That is how they are presented. You will find the identical thing in the Atharva Veda, which goes back at least 1,000 years before the birth of Jesus. As a result of realizing that state which is represented by the god Soma, Soma, the Lord of Inspiration, as a result of that, he is able to enable the lame to walk, the blind to see, the deaf to hear. It's openly stated. You see? Now, this is something which we don't appreciate sufficiently. We think that by living the religious life, we shall get something wonderful for ourselves, some transcendental happiness, or we'll go off into wonderful inner realms and mysterious states which are full of wonder and, a kind of a super excitement. Nothing of the sort. In perfection, there is nothing for me. Absolutely nothing. I do the work. It is God, it is transcendence who reaps the fruit. Now I have to know that right from the beginning. I reap nothing. Because I am just a finite, limited expression of the infinite. I am like a frail web spun on the loom of time. But if I, a frail web spun on the loom of time, purify myself so that transcendence realizes itself, there is another star shining in the heavens to light the way for man and give him joy with its beauty. This is what happens. But there is nothing for me. That we must realize. Understanding this, we can look into the statements made by two of the great teachers who have lived in our world. Let us take the statements made regarding himself by the Buddha. And this is what he says. His conduct, he's talking of himself, his conduct in thought, speech and action is that of the perfect saint. He himself calls this the observation of the mere details of minor morality. If we take the trouble to study the text, we will find that the mere details of minor morality are characteristics of a perfected saint. He says that he himself discards whatever is unessential for living the holy life. And this is the true meaning of asceticism. Not to torment yourself, not to hurt yourself, and certainly not to hurt others, but to see for yourself, this is not essential for living the simple, beautiful human life. And when you really see it, you just put it aside. You don't bother about it. This is asceticism. Ascesis, the Greek word, which means a removal of all that is unnecessary. Like the work of a sculptor. What does a sculptor do? There is a block of metal or stone or whatever it is, and he removes what is not necessary, and lo and behold, a thing of sheer beauty is released. It is like that. The Buddha refers to himself as an arahat. An arahat, the word arahant simply means the worthy one. Its physical meaning in the physical world is the man who tills the ground, who grows the crops, and is the good husbandman, supporting others. That is the worthy one, not a conqueror or anything like that. He calls himself an Arahant, the worthy one. And he declares that he himself is one who can never intentionally take the life of any living thing or steal, take what is not given. He cannot indulge in all sorts of sense pleasures, which are quite unnecessary for living the pure life. He cannot intentionally tell a lie. He cannot enjoy pleasures from savings, you know, like we save up for the holiday and then have an exciting good time, as we call it, spending that money. He doesn't do that. He's happy wherever he is. Everything is holiday for him. It is a holy day. This is its real meaning. He is one in whom all the evils which afflict man are quite removed. He cannot go astray through desire, through hate, through delusion, through fear. This is the perfected Holy One. And this is the sort of life he leads. This is the end of it all, if you like. So you see, there can be no selfish motive, no foolish sort of picture of a marvelous goal for the disciple who is a wise disciple. He puts all that aside. What does Jesus say about himself? On one memorable occasion, on which Simon Peter knew him through divine inspiration for what he was, in the coasts of Caesarea Philippi, Jesus asks his own chosen disciples, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" And the disciples said, "Some say thou art John the Baptist, some say you are Elias," that is Elijah, "others say Jeremiah or one of the prophets." Then Jesus asks, "But whom say ye that I am?" And Simon Peter's voice rings out, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." Words that live as the undying echo of the thunder of eternity. And the correspondent of this in the Indian scriptures is when the Holy One says, "Aham Brahmasmi. Brahman is me. I am Brahman." The ultimate real. Because he said this, the Jews condemned him. Jesus gave so much cause to annoy and upset the established order of the day. And every man of vision cannot avoid giving cause for annoyance by the established order of the day. Jesus said, "I am the bread of life. I came down from heaven." Exactly as it is said of the Buddha, that he was in the Tushita heaven and he came down to earth into the womb of the lady Mahamaya, his mother. "Whoso eateth my flesh and drinketh my blood," this is all symbolical, and you have to know your Kabbalistic teachings in order to appreciate what it means, "hath eternal life. I am the light of the world. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd giveth his life for the sheep." My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me, and I give unto them eternal life. I am the Son of God. He said that outright when Caiaphas asked him, Art thou the Son of the Blessed? And he said, I am. I am the true vine, and my Father is the husbandman. I am in the Father, and the Father in me. This is what two of the great teachers said of themselves. But you see what their lives were. The embodiment of supreme virtue, which came to fruition in its own unique way through the being of these people who realized transcendence.